Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning with us live is Chandler Klang Smith. We're also going to have a movie review, and I'm going to have to talk a little bit about the station, huh? Yes, we are here, we are live, we are not, at least I am not going away quite yet. Hopefully I will be with the station for a while longer. There's no news that Hour of the Wolf will be taken off the air. So, WBAI may end up in, the deeper doo-doo hole that we are already deep in. We're more than knee-deep. And that is why these horrible... The word I've been using online is draconian measures have occurred to the station. It sounds heartless to say this is something that was a long time in coming and might have been a little less painful if it had been done earlier. If it had been done a year ago, maybe instead of losing 3/4 of the staff, maybe we would have only lost 1/4 or half the staff or something like that. But I will say outright, that WBAI has been mismanaged for a very, long time now, more than a decade. And we have been hemorrhaging money. And we're not the only Pacifica station that has done it. If you were listening to the Pacifica executive director and our new program director, just before on recording from last Friday, you know that. So it's pretty crappy. You know, it's pretty sad and all that. But another way to look at this is this is a last-ditch attempt to save the station, okay? And one of the things that's going to have to happen, I agree with Summer Reese on one thing, which is that, and Andrew Phillips, who was, who I worked with when he was the program director 20 years ago, and he actually put me into the position of being a war correspondent right from our master control room. I hosted a daily show called The War Report during the first Iraq War because of my deep insight into politics. Now, anybody who knows me knows that's a joke. I have no insight into politics whatsoever, which is actually why he put me on. Because anybody else would have to, you know, show their acumen or something. The point is that I wasn't afraid to ask, well, exactly how did Kuwait come into being? It's a different way of thinking. And, well, the funniest thing is when the show actually got reviewed in the Village Voice and I was called a very canny, insightful kind of person. That's what came across. So we're going to be doing more experiments in radio, and it's really time that we did more experimental. Most of those changes at this time are going to be prime time. 5 a.m. to... morning drive and afternoon drive, okay? 10 hours a week. I wouldn't be surprised if this all ends up going network. They haven't said it, but just prediction. Okay, so had to get that out. We have a review. Dan Persons has reviewed Elysium for us, and I haven't actually even listened to the review yet, so we'll all catch it together if I can figure out what drive I put it into. There it is. Okay, good. So we're going to listen to that, and then I told you, Chandler, how informal it gets, where I can go in the air and go blah, blah, blah. And then we will talk with Chandler Klang Smith. Please stay tuned. I didn't edit that properly, did I?
Hour of the Wolf. Hey, I'm Dan Persons, movie critic for Hour of the Wolf. No doubt about it, Elysium is the best remake of Total Recall I've seen. Not literally, of course, not point by point, although there are weird little parallels that crop up here and there. But overall, there is something in this dystopic, man-against-the-system action-adventure film that suggests what Total Recall, the original one, might have been had it not starred walking cartoon Arnold Schwarzenegger and had director Paul Verhoeven not taken such an arch tone with his material. The star of Elysium is Matt Damon. The director is Neil Blomkamp, who previously did the low-budget and incisive Alien Refugees on Earth film District 9, and who here brings the same cutting attitude, just on a more mainstream-friendly scale. As for the story, well, anyone who saw After Earth, all three of you, will have a bit of deja vu here. Some 150 years in the future, we've once again righteously bollocksed up the Earth. Pollution, global warming, you know the deal. This time, though, it's only the 1%ers who get their butts off the planet and into an orbiting space station called Elysium, the interior of which looks like every science fiction magazine illustration you've ever seen about an orbiting community. You know, the whole deal with the vast landscape arcs up into the distance. Specifically here, that landscape alternates between McMansions and replicas of the Garden of Versailles, and is actually quite convincing. Very good CG throughout this film. They've got their own government, they've got their own homeland security, headed up by Jodie Foster playing Dick Cheney's wet dream, and each luxury home, all of them, apparently, has its own special medibed that can heal any disease. Because hospitals are just so third world, you know. As for the other 99%, well, they're stuck on Earth in vast slums, working poor, trapped in a system rigged to keep them down. Like District 9, there's more than a little reflection of the oppressive history of Blomkamp's South Africa here, although it's kind of amazing how easily the analogy can be flexed to reflect present social conditions in the U.S., most specifically the ongoing turmoil over Obamacare. The oppression goes double for Matt Damon's character, Max, a former car thief previously incarcerated and now trying to reform. Not that the man will let him, he just needs to fart in the wrong direction, and a few extra months of parole go onto his ankle bracelet. It doesn't help that an industrial accident at his job has him receiving a lethal dose of radiation that gives him only 5 days to live. His only chance for survival, getting his butt up to Elysium and into one of those medibeds. Just coincidentally, Max has also had a reunion with his childhood crush, played by Alice Braga, who now has a young daughter who's dying of leukemia and could use a spin in one of those medibeds as well. Just coincidentally, Max hooks up with a crime boss who could smuggle him up onto Elysium, and who in exchange wants Max to mind jack some data out of the head of a powerful industrialist played by William Fichtner, acting all William Fichtner-y here, which means he's a right bastard. Just coincidentally, that crime boss can also hook Max up in a cyborg rig that'll keep his radiation-ravaged body going, and just coincidentally, that hijacked data turns out to be a program that could radically rewrite the social order, turning Max into a mech-enhanced hot potato sought after by a number of factions, including a psychotic mercenary played by District 9's Charlto Copley. That enough plot for you? Too much, maybe. Yeah, it is chaotic. All the pieces don't exactly fit neatly. And God knows, Elysium also has no shortage of action sequences in between, what with skyjacking luxury spaceships, kidnappings, cyborg-on-cyborg violence. Blomkamp, by the way, does succumb to the present-day weakness for filming all of this with shaky cam. You don't need that, Neil. Just choreograph the fight scenes right and shoot them so we can see what's going on. Please. Nevertheless, Elysium is fun. Blomkamp's goal here is clearly entertainment first, with a bit of social commentary thrown in, and the balance works. It doesn't quite have the impact of District 9. The strength of that film was that, working smaller, Blomkamp could better focus his commentary, and the specificity was its strength. Here, the demands of a mainstream tentpole project has made things just a bit more generic. As my colleague Lawrence French pointed out when we were discussing this, this particular story goes all the way back to Metropolis. You won't be too surprised at how things work out. But if the plot is kind of old school, neither is it just off-the-rack lip service to socially-minded science fiction. Blomkamp makes his analogies land, keeps the stories twisting in ways that keep things fresh, and most importantly, makes you believe that the stakes are real, keeping you invested in these people's fates. Elysium is not Landmark. It is certainly keen, late-summer entertainment with a bit of soul to it, and that's fine. I'm Dan Persons. You can check out more about the world of fantastic film over at CineFantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
Yes, and good morning. You don't know why I'm chuckling, and be glad that you don't know why I'm chuckling. Because BAI right now is not a very chuckly place, having lost most of its staff. But some programs go on. This one certainly will. Lister's Burn Baby Burn Clapper will go on. Only now you get followed by the program director. You know that. Oh, my God, you should see. Yeah, Andrew Phillips comes on at 5 a.m. Yes. You haven't looked at the new schedule. He considers 5 a.m. prime time. Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, it's prime time. So he's going to be doing 5 a.m. until he decides to do something else. Okay, I'll just tell one Yeah, I won't tell this week about how Andrew Phillips once suspended me from WBAI, and I thought he was lenient. Let's do Hour of the Wolf, shall we? I was halfway. I spoke to Chandler, our guest this morning, Chandler Klangsmith. Yeah, except I have to find the right mic. Let's try that again.
Thanks for having me on the show.
That one worked. Okay,
good. Terrific.
And I wasn't even sure, given the current events of the station here, whether I should just like go on the air and take calls or do a show. And I asked Andrew's opinion, and he says, you know, do whatever's right, Jimmy Pye. And so I decided properly to do a show, because also I wanted to have Chandler on, and also because Reggie Johnson did a whole call-in show, and other people are doing call-in shows, and I will be talking about the events of WBAI on the air in time to come. My airtime is not getting, you know, cut down, so I'll be around, and there's plenty of time to do it, but you know, it's also time for mourning. MOURNING. But Hour of the Wolf goes on, and I better damn well start it because we're 15 minutes into the show. Good morning, Chandler.
Good morning to you.
Thank you. So I met you through Karen Hewler.
Yeah, Karen and I are both published by Cheezine Publications. So,
yeah, which is actually a very cool publisher.
Yeah, they absolutely are. I really like a lot of their authors, Nick Kaufman and Helen Marshall. They're both really talented. And I recently read her story collection, Hairside, Fleshside, and really enjoyed it. So, yeah.
I haven't read that. Yeah.
Yeah, you should check it
Nick
out.
Nick Kaufman, I know. I haven't read it. It's
oh,
terrible.
You have to read Chasing the Dragon. That's a fantastic
book. I have on recording one of his, he did a KGB reading.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I missed that.
I made it to that one. It was very cool.
Gordon Lindsner. I gave him my old microphone, and he records them for me. So I have it.
Terrific.
And I'll have to listen to it, maybe one day even broadcast it if it's broadcast.
Yeah, well, Chasing the Dragon is a real page-turner, and CZP is always doing really interesting stuff, so I'm really glad to be part of their stable of writers.
Yeah. And I've heard of a book called Golden Land After Dark.
Have yeah, you? That is my book. So it's about circus performers in the 1960s, and centers around a clown named Vibram Bell, who as his situation gets progressively worse, actually similarly to this radio station, he's with a circus that's kind of...
That's right. There are parallels. Yeah. Very unfortunate parallels.
As you've been talking about radio, I've been thinking about how it kind of parallels circuses in the 1960s, when it was an era when they were, kind of fading from the cultural memory, but there were still people who were really passionate practitioners of the art. Mm. And so... it's kind of about that struggle to stay relevant and find an audience and, stay financially afloat, which is actually kind of what the passage I'll be reading from the book is about. It's about a circus that's about to go under. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now the it's funny because, you know, two of the best books that I've enjoyed. I haven't finished Golden Land After Dark, but I've read all of part one.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah.
And Genevieve Valentine's Now, the name of her, I remember the subtitle, Tale of the Circus Trizalti, but that.
I have not read it, so I'm not familiar with it.
You must, and she got a Nebula nomination.
Well, I'm sure it's
too
awesome. Yeah, I've heard of her as a writer, but I haven't read any of her
She's
work.
Also has been a movie reviewer for the same radio show.
Terrific,
so,
yeah.
Except she put herself on hiatus.
Mm-hmm.
I hope she'll come back. Where Dan Persons is doing, you know, the tentpole big budget movies.
Right.
She does the indies. She does a great movie blog, by the way.
I'll have to check that out because I'm always looking for smaller films that I might not have heard of.
Oh,
so,
she's the one to go to and talk about snark. She's got...
Seems like a necessary ingredient in film reviewing.
She's good at it. You know, she's really clever and good. I don't always agree.
Yeah.
But hey, that's, you know,
Yeah, just starting the conversation is something.
But two really cool spec fic novels in the last year on circuses. The big, big difference. Hers doesn't have clowns.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah. Is she one of the people who is terrified of clowns?
Not she. She doesn't like them.
Yeah.
But a person who has been a regular guest on this show. I should probably not say.
Because then clowns could be sent to torment that person. So
yeah,
that would
exactly.
be very hazardous.
But she's somebody you've met. And she's a brilliant writer and all that. But I have a recording implement that has a big red windscreen on front. And all I had to do was put that on my face and she was screaming. This is a professor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm really intrigued by the phenomenon of people being terrified of clowns because obviously I'm not, or I wouldn't have been able to write this book.
But, I recently posted a thing on my Facebook page about clownophobia or whatever.
Oh, terrific! I'll have to check that out later. But
about 2 or 3 weeks ago that I posted that.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by the phenomenon, and I've been trying to think about maybe some of the reasons why people are so scared of clowns. There's actually a part in my book where after, this tiny ramshackle circus that the Faber and Bell is part of goes under, he ends up becoming part of this this larger circus that's kind of based on a Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey type show. And one of the first things that happens is something that I discovered in my research actually happened back in the day among circus clowns, that one of the circus clowns accuses him of stealing his face. And I thought that was there's something really terrifying about that expression, you stole my face. It was when a circus clown would too closely imitate the grease paint, the style of the grease paint.
Which are trademarked, in essence. Yeah.
They actually, I believe that
they
there's...
They paint them on eggs.
Yes, I have heard about that. They paint them on eggs, and
Episode of The Avengers. Now, excuse me, youngsters, but The Avengers was a TV series starring Diana Rigg and Patrick McNee. Thank you, Lister. I hope all radio listeners see Lister raising his fist in the air going, yes, yes. And not that I didn't like the movie The Avengers, but The Avengers are that British couple. And there's an episode, which actually I think is a Tara King episode, but nevertheless, in which I think it's actually John Cleese, of all people, keeps from Monty Python, is the keeper of all of these eggshells.
Oh, that's
They're trying
terrific.
To identify a clown, and they look at all the eggshells with the clown faces on it, and it is...
Sort of like the police lineup for clowns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
But, I'm really intrigued by that idea of there's a kind of doubleness to the clown persona that, that you have your face, but then you have your clown face. That face can be stolen. It can be appropriated by someone else. It can be lost to you. And in some way, that sort of implies there's almost a separate entity. And that's actually another plot thread that develops in my book, the protagonist, as things go into the toilet for his personal life and ultimately his career, he ends up having this imaginary friend from his childhood returns to his life, and the line between fantasy and reality somewhat blurs because he is no longer sure if it's, if what's real and what's in his imagination. And I think that there's something about clowning that there's a very obvious external transformation that kind of scares us because it is like the person has been taken over by their art. Their art is actually obscuring their features and making them into something that's not as recognizably human. So, yeah.
I think somebody pointed out that for the most part, clowns are not funny.
I've got to say I kind of disagree with that. I mean, I think that it depends on... Well, one thing is it kind of depends on how you define a clown. I think that in contemporary culture, we just no longer call the performers who do clown-like routines clowns. there's an episode of Seinfeld where Kramer talks about how he's terrified of clowns, and there's this whole hilarious scene where he's outside of an opera and this clown comes out of, you know, the door to the dressing room, and they have a very spooky
Pagliacci,
conversation.
No doubt.
Pagliacci, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
yeah, they have a very spooky conversation, and it's really funny that, you know, he's terrified of clowns and the clown is this sort of menacing, strange figure. But what the show doesn't explicitly point out, but I think is implicit whenever you're watching it, is that Kramer himself is a clown. He has the clown hair. He's constantly pratfalling. So much of his humor.
He's got that physique.
Yeah,
he
has the clown physique. His
I didn't even watch the show, but I'm not, you know, I know culture.
He wears the sort of the high water pants. You know, the sort of like there's something very very hobo like about a lot of his attire. You know, his facial expressions and reactions are really the source of his humor. I mean, it's all of the stuff that makes a clown minus the grease paint. So I think that actually clowns can be very funny, but they've become kind of, you know, kind of ghettoized and treated as a relic from the past. So, you know, but I think
speaking of being ghettoized and a relic of the past, this is WBAI in New York City. I had to do that. Thank you, Lister. And I got Chandler, too, so hopefully the three people out there listening enjoyed it as well. How did you research this?
Well, I did a combination of things. I went to a lot of circus shows. I went to pretty much all of the ones that were in, you know, in any area where I was, I would try to seek out. I saw Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. I saw a Seattle-based performance troupe, Circus Contraption, that I was telling you about a little before the show. I went to the Coney Island Sideshow a bunch of times. I saw the New York Goofs perform at the Flea Theater. They're a clown troupe. So that just gave me a lot of...
Big Apple?
I did not go to the Big Apple Circus. I've heard a lot about it. But, yeah, I haven't had a chance yet.
Yeah, they had a clown thing, I think, named Granny, who is a...
I actually went to an exhibit that was at this gallery that's owned by Bard College, I think, but it's here in the city, and they had a thing about the clown Granny that,
yeah.
I was really intrigued. So, so I went to a lot of circus shows, but I also, you know, I watched films. I really love Charlie Chaplin's The Circus.
Mm-hmm.
Chaplin's an example to me of another clown who is hilarious. I mean, especially in that film.
I'm more of a Buster Keaton type. But...
Yeah, Buster Keaton is also, I would categorize him as a clown. But there's a terrific sequence.
Both of them are. Harold Lloyd. I mean, those are the big three.
Right, yeah. So I saw that film. I've seen Todd Browning's Freaks, which is a film I wouldn't necessarily recommend.
Is that circus or is that carnival?
That's about a sideshow, which is another element in this book.
Yeah.
When Weber and Bell joins the larger circus in the second half.
There's a circus, yeah.
Yeah, in the second half of the book, there's the Parliament of Freaks that's what I call it in my novel, where his girlfriend, the lizard girl, and a friend of hers who has no arms and calls herself Venus de Milo, both perform.
Right.
But yeah, so I saw those films. I saw The Greatest Show on Earth, which is where the epigraph to my novel came from.
Yeah, there's a move. I mean, the whole Jimmy Stewart thing, I'm sorry.
I was so fascinated by that. That's actually the epigraph is from Jimmy Stewart. He says, they'll never find me behind the snows. And I think that kind of touches on the other thing that is frightening about clowns, that it almost seems like a disguise in a way, like, there's the possibility that someone's been so consumed with their art that they've become some kind of slightly less than human creature. But then there's also the possibility that they're actually trying to conceal something about their identity. And he walks around in full clown makeup the entire movie, and no one is suspicious, which is just the oddest thing. So,
Exactly. And he's a alleged murderer.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's... spoilers.
Yeah, spoiler. Spoiler
alert.
You know,
when it's a Cecil B. DeMille film, there's no such thing as a spoiler. You know,
it's
coming.
Yeah. It's a really unintentionally funny movie.
I don't watch it often.
Emmett Kelly is in it for 5 minutes, I think. Yeah.
I actually saw him perform.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw him. One of the most amazing circuses that I ever saw was the Moscow Circus.
Oh, nice.
And we're talking, I mean, I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
So we're probably talking about 1961.
Right.
And at Madison Square Garden, the old Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they would get away with what they we're doing then today, because a lot of animal acts, a lot of bears.
Right.
Bears actually somersaulting and on roller skates, and penguins on roller skates. I have a penguin fetish.
Wow. Yeah. So, I have a friend who's a big fan of penguins. So, yeah. They're a cool animal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of my wallpapers are penguins, you know.
That's terrific. Yeah.
Stuffed animals all over the house. Anyway.
No, but I also saw Cirque du Soleil, which is sort of the extreme opposite of that. You know, no animal acts, not even really recognizable circus roles, or, you know, isn't the ringmaster or clowns in a traditional sense. But I just saw a show
which was a circus show and not Pippin.
Oh, how is that?
Oh, it was wonderful.
Terrific.
Wonderful, yeah. Let me just say. I saw the original with Ben Vereen and, you know, the original Fosse choreography, and I'm a big Fosse fan. This show is almost more Fosse than that show. But what the director, Diane Paulus, has done is she's brought in a circus.
Yeah.
Where before it just had this sort of minstrel show kind of hatcha kind of thing. And there were circus elements in the original show.
Right.
But this is a circus, down to and including the point where there's a guy on about 9 circular tubes.
Wow.
Standing. You can't imagine how this gets done. Then takes a hula hoop, puts it on his nose, and one of the lead characters jumps through the hula hoop.
That is extraordinary. You know,
and that's just typical of what's going on. And all the actors in the show. Andrea Martin from Second City TV plays the grandma in this show. And she comes out, and it's pitiful. She looks so old and stuff. She's got a cane, and she does her song. In the second verse of the song, she drops the cane, but she's all right. And then a moment later, she takes off the coat, and she's in tights.
Wow.
Revealing tights. And the third verse of the song, she's swinging from a trapeze.
This
woman has 65 has come and gone.
That's
for
how
her.
I want to spend my golden years. Yeah,
and she's doing it. And so the whole show is a circus act with Bob Fosse choreography and Stephen Schwartz music. It's expensive beyond belief.
Right.
And I'm glad I spent the money. And I don't always say that.
Yeah, no, that's very high praise for a Broadway show. It was worth the price of admission. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it cost 2 people $300.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of money for a BAI volunteer.
No, definitely.
But I'm glad I spent it. I'll be yapping about it for about 3 weeks ago. And
terrific, yeah.
So sorry. You mentioned Cirque du Soleil, and that reminded me.
Yeah, that sounds very Cirque du Soleil in terms of the choreography.
It very much is. It very much is, only with an actual and with the Fosse dancing.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
But and in terms of research, I read a lot of books. I read, speaking of sideshows, there was a really interesting one called Secrets of the Sideshow by Joe Nickel that I'd recommend. It's one of my favorite nonfiction books on circuses that I checked out, and I looked at a lot of them. So, I had a professor in undergrad who, Edward Hoagland, a writer who actually traveled in the 1950s with the circus and helped with the big cats. So he was a really interesting resource, and I heard, you know, circus stories firsthand from him as well as reading his book. So, yeah. But there's a wealth of really interesting literature on the subject. It's, you know, if I can contribute to that a little bit, then that makes me happy. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, you certainly have.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. Do you want to read from it?
Sure.
Do you want to take a break first?
It's totally up to you, but I'm ready to go.
No, it's totally up to you. Oh, no, if you're ready to go, go.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think I kind of set up this excerpt a little bit earlier, but I'll just go ahead and reintroduce it.
And no, I'm not ignoring you. I'm setting up music.
Oh, that's totally fine. So tonight I'll be reading an excerpt from my novel, and as I said before, this book centers on a character named Vabron Bell. What I don't think I said about him before is that he's a stunted and hunchbacked young man who performs as a clown, and he's travels with the circus in 1960s America. The first half of the novel follows his adventures with a tiny ramshackle circus helmed by the charismatic but delusional ringmaster Dr. Show. And plagued by debt, bad luck, and even worse decisions, in this section, the troupe puts on their final disastrous performance. So this is from Golden Land Past Dark. Thaburn pushed and elbowed and sidled his way to an empty seat in the middle of the most crowded row of bleachers. His floppy shoes slapped the ground, and his loosened tie swung wildly to and fro. He held an enormous bucket of popcorn with both hands. With every step he took, he managed to douse the audience with another fistful of kernels. By the time he reached his seat, the bucket was completely empty. In lieu of discarding it, he turned it upside down and dropped it over the head of a middle-aged man sitting directly in front of him. Inside, he breathed a sigh of relief. He'd been using the same batch of popcorn for over a week, and it was getting incredibly stale. Now, he was finally out. Instead of performing his whole routine, Thaburn had agreed to warm up the crowd before the evening show began, but except for a few titters here and there, he wasn't sure he was making too much of an impression. The middle-aged man pulled the bucket off his head and tossed it away without so much as glancing at him. Somewhere behind him, Thaburn heard the unmistakable and terrifying sound of a child's yawn. He turned around and, rubbing his eyes sleepily, yawned right back. Time to make himself comfortable. He pulled off his floppy shoes, revealing a pair of red and white striped socks with noticeable holes in the toe, then stretched his legs as far as he could and smacked the middle-aged man with his heel. Served him right. Scowling, the guy turned around, finally, and murmuring gravely, Thaburn mimed elaborate apologies. He removed his oversized, limp-brimmed fedora. Beneath that was a straw pork pie hat, a piece of wheat stuck jauntily in his red, white, and blue band. Thaburn shook his head, continuing to murmur, and with a flourish removed the second hat. Beneath that was a baby's bonnet. A high-pitched whistle trilled off stage. Thaburn pulled on his shoes and hats, and with deep bows to the crowd, sidled his way back out of the bleachers, leading with his hump. He made a show of moving unsteadily, clumsily, down to the ground, but as soon as he was out of sight, he scrambled to his post at the top of the ladder. Tonight, he was working the lights. The splintery wood creaked beneath him as he carefully took his seat on the narrow top rung. He tried to keep his mind off the 12 feet between him and the hard dirt ground, more than triple his height. Perched there, high above the top row of bleachers, he had a god's view of the audience, but there wasn't much to see this evening. Two tow-headed boys took turns snapping each other with a broken rubber band. A sad-looking old lady knitted a shawl that was already unraveling around her narrow shoulders. The middle-aged man, who Thaburn now noticed wore some vaguely institutional coveralls, still sat speckled with popcorn kernels. Thaburn couldn't imagine how they felt, squirming on the hard benches he'd helped to build. He couldn't guess what had brought them there. He snapped off the house lights and waited a long moment in the smoky dark. Finally, he switched on the spotlight and swung his beam in a slow arc to Dr. Sho, who had just entered the ring through the flaps at the opposite end of the tent. The big top wasn't big enough to conceal the performers off stage, so the troupe stood just outside, huddled near the makeshift entrance, whispering to each other and listening for their cues. In the first few weeks after he had joined the circus, Thaburn had liked those times best, had savored the anticipation, the tenseness he felt before unicycling or tumbling or dancing into the light. Those moments had a kind of ritual significance to him, as though, when he stepped through the dirty canvas, he would come out transformed, painted a shade too resplendent for even him to imagine. And despite their grumbling and gossip, their yawns and last-minute smokes, he had always suspected that deep down, the other performers felt the same. Now he wasn't so sure. It was better to be up here, with the hot casing of the bulbs burning his hands, than out there in the night, surrounded by a crew of players who, come morning, might well disappear down the road, making their short journey back to the land of strangers. "Ladies and gentlemen," Schoenberg intoned, "boys and girls, tonight I present for your approval a wondrous exhibition. In my travels around the globe, I have assembled a collection of human oddities which reveal the darker side of our maker's genius. This evening, for your elucidation, I will introduce the malformed, the twisted, the shrunken, contorted, gifted, and strange, anomalies that lie beyond the understanding of medical science, creatures whose existence may lead you to question the very tenets of your cherished philosophy. Once visited by these specters, you may find yourself forever changed, haunted by what no man was meant to see with waking eyes. I urge you to turn back now. Make your way to the exits, for the horrors that lie ahead are not for the faint of heart. But a single word of warning. Should you choose to stay, please remain seated for the duration of the performance. Once brought before you, some of my creatures become petulant and difficult to restrain. An explosion of blue-white smoke engulfed Dr. Sho, and Vaberin snapped the spotlight off. Too abruptly, probably. He'd only done the lighting a couple of times before. Tonight, though, it wasn't just inexperience that made Vaberin switch off the beam so soon. Dr. Sho had looked terrible out there, his eyes sleepless and hooded, his bow tie crooked and drooping. He almost did look like a man haunted by the things he'd seen. Vaberin quickly fitted the first colored gel onto the light, yellow, then snapped the bulb back on. Aang's act was first, and he was already out there, clad in his leotard, waiting when the spotlight hit him. Quickly, with a dexterity that still made Vaberin flinch, Aang stood on his hands, bent his legs over his back until his feet rested on his shoulder blades, and began to dart around the ring. He was out of sorts, though, a bit too perfunctory and quick, and the audience clapped dully, unamazed. Only later, if at all, would they realize the impossibility of what they'd seen. Aang sprang back to his feet and twisted around at the waist till facing almost backwards. His pained smile showed the strain. Over the coughs and crackling candy wrappers of the audience, Vaberin heard Aang's vertebrae pop. The conjoined twins Vlad and Fedor had taken the night off, complaining of not one but two debilitating headaches, so Vaberin was thankfully spared their hokey patter. Instead, Brunhilde was next. Vaberin fixed a pink gel on the light. Brunhilde always complained that it made her look tawdry. In fact, it lent her a feminine softness, accentuating the suppleness of her strong, bare arms, the smoothness of her towering, pillar-like legs. But tonight, as Vaberin turned the beam back on, he realized that Brunhilde's appearance was beyond salvaging. Ignoring the advice of the other performers, who always urged her to let her long gold hair go free, she'd done it up in two braids that hung, heavy and unappealing as coils of rope, down to her ample bosom. Worse yet, she'd managed to find her Viking horn helmet. Vaberin would have sworn he'd hidden it deep in the Cadillac's trunk somewhere. The result was that she looked more like a Wagnerian transvestite than a bearded lady. As she opened her lips to sing the first lines of a German folk song, peals of laughter predictably silenced her. For a moment, Vaberin wondered if she had intentionally sabotaged her own performance, but Brunhilde's gaze to the audience, a dagger of pure hatred, was enough to set him straight. The fact was, she still believed, after everything, that she looked better that way. After Brunhilde, it was generally Al's turn to go. Privately, Vaberin had never thought the big guy was used quite right in the show. If Vaberin had been planning things, he would have capitalized on the otherworldly quality of giants. He might have dressed Al in animal skins and given him a rock to sit on, perhaps even powdered his face, and tried to pass him off as a creature who lived, solitary and thoughtful, deep in an ice cave at the very top of the world. Al's enormous hands, long and bony and double-jointed, his stretched-out funhouse face, fascinated people, made them shiver. Vaberin had seen it happen. But instead of casting Al as a Norse god, Dr. Sho had made a gaffed strongman out of him. Al lifted barbells made out of balloons and flexed the negligible muscles in his spindly arms, and his strength had convinced no one. Maybe it was the meager applause that had finally driven him back out onto the road. Dr. Sho returned to the stage. Vaberin could tell by the way he moved that he'd had a few swigs of something since he last appeared. He gestured grandly, but less precisely now, swinging his arm back toward the entrance no one was supposed to see, his voice rich with the kind of merriment that leads easily to tears. "Such horrifying visions! But now I offer some respite. This next performance will warm the cockles of your hearts, my beloved audience. In it you will see the lion lie down with the lamb, as it were, the amity of man and ferocious beast. Oh yes, for there is still tenderness in this world, despite appearances to the contrary. Yes indeed, oh yes indeed. At any rate I present Explorer Hank and his Jungle Cats." Chuckling, Schoenberg wandered off stage. Vaberin switched the gel to orange and counted to 100 before turning the lights back on. Explorer Hank took a few minutes to set up, and the clangs and thuds of his equipment filled the dark big top. Normally, Schoenberg played his concertina at this point to cover the noise, but apparently he'd forgotten. Explorer Hank was a favorite of audiences, or at least of children, who cooed with wonder any time the baby tigers came on stage. Once, at a particularly successful performance, a little girl had bravely slipped from the front row when Hank's back was turned to stroke Ginger's humming throat, her flicking, toy-like tail. They had all felt the danger that night, huddled outside the tent's back door, though small Ginger still had teeth and claws far fiercer than an ordinary kitten's. But the audience had trusted her completely, had even rippled the bleachers with spontaneous applause. Now, though, that all had changed. Fred, perched on the bottom of an upside-down trash can, looked half-grown and feral, despite the bow tied around his neck. When the lights came up, he was bent double, one leg in the air, licking himself. Ginger, still small as a bobcat, was a patchwork of thinning fur and angry, irritated areas of skin. The light caught Explorer Hank still setting up a steel hoop between the cats, and he looked out at the audience, blinking in surprise, for several seconds before he spoke. "Well, hi there, guys and gals. Let me start out by saying that me and Ginger and Freddy here are real glad you came out for the show tonight. Before we came on stage, the kids were saying to me, 'Boy, we sure hope we get to show off our tricks tonight, Hank.' And I was saying, 'Gee, I do too, because otherwise I'm out of a job. Ha ha, we like to joke a little, the kids and me. But anywho, how many of you have seen a real live tiger before?'" Whenever Explorer Hank came on stage, some part of Vaburn shriveled inside. Hank was folksy, ingratiating, but he was also desperate for approval, and the need shone on his face like sweat. He was struggling now, losing ground. The two cats, trained to bat a beach ball back and forth, balked tonight. Hank tossed it at Fred, who batted it offstage, hopped down from his trash can, and slunk away in the opposite direction. As Hank ran to scoop up Fred and return him to his post, Ginger jumped down from hers and began rubbing the abraded skin of her back on the tent's dirt floor. All the while, Hank kept up a stream of patter that sank from self-deprecation to apology to muttering to himself. "There you go, now stay. If I can just get these guys to stay put a minute. Oh, no, you don't." By the time he finally got the two cats ensconced again, the crowd was so restless he had to raise his voice to be heard. "Well, since you folks have been so patient, let me go ahead and skip to the big finale," Hank announced, his smile a slice of pain cut from his face. He lit a match and held it to the steel hoop, which suddenly blazed. "Kids love to show this one off, let me tell you." Hank positioned himself on the side of the hoop by Ginger, looking over at Freddy through the ring of fire. "First, Freddy, you jump through. I'll be here to catch you." Hank reached out his arms. "Come here, big guy. You can do it." Freddy yawned and stretched, then made to jump down to the ground again. "No, through the hoop, Buster." If Vaburn hadn't known better, he would have sworn he saw Freddy shake his head. The cat yawned a second time, then curled into a donut of orange fur and closed his eyes. Hank, arms still outstretched, stood flabbergasted. "Boys will be boys," he finally said. He walked around the ring of fire and poked Freddy, who released a guttural snore. "But Ginger, you'll show the nice people what you can do, huh? Baby girl?" Ginger, staring through the fire at him, began to stiffen. Her patchy fur bristled and her lips parted to reveal teeth in a nervous snarl. She batted at her face with one paw. Vaburn tried to imagine leaping through the hoop without his glasses on. He wondered how many whiskers she had shed, but Hank had forgotten, or else no longer cared. "Ginger girl, don't leave Daddy waiting." Hank held his arms out. "You can do it. You've done it a million times." Ginger's eyes opened wide. Finally, hissing, she drew away from the fire. This time, Explorer Hank didn't apologize or explain. He drew out his whip from the belt of his khakis and cracked it in the air. Still, Ginger didn't move. She kept her head turned away. Hank cracked the whip again and again, but she wouldn't look at him, nor would Freddy stir. Explorer Hank's smile shrank to a scowl, and he lowered the brim of the pith helmet to shade his eyes. "Funny thing about kids," he said. "You can love them all you want, but they test you. Yes, they do. So you have to show them who's boss. I'm doing this for your own good, Gingy." Hank strode over to Ginger, picked her up by the scruff of the neck, and threw her through the hoop. The cub hit the dirt floor like a sack of flour. She did not land on her feet, and she limped a little as she scampered, whimpering, out the back entrance. Thanks.
Everything nice. I've got your future sewn up if you'll take this advice.
You've been listening to Chandler Klang Smith reading from her novel, Goldenland Past Dark.
And you ride the road to romance. A butcher or a baker, ladies never embrace.
A barber for a ball would be a social disgrace.
They all will come to call if you can fall on your face. Be a clown, be a clown, be a clown.
With your rent in arrears.
Why be a major poet and you'll owe it for years?
When crowds will pay to giggle if you winkle your ears. Be a clown, be a clown, be a clown. Be a clown, be a clown. All the world loves a clown.
Be the poor, silly ass.
You'll always travel for first class.
Give them quips, give them fun, and they'll pay to say you're A1.
If you become a farmer, you've the weather to buck.
If you become a gambler, you'll be stuck with your luck.
But Jack, you'll never lack if you can quack like a duck. Be a clown, be a clown, be a clown. Be a clown, be a clown.
That was Make 'em Laugh by Cole Porter. No, that was Be a Clown by Cole Porter. It was Cole Porter. Well, it's Judy and it was Gene, but he cannibalized his own song for that bizarre movie, The Pirate, which is bizarre.
I have not seen that. I've seen Singing in the Rain, but not that
there,
one.
There is a scene where Judy Garland is wearing like this little bonnet kind of a thing, pretending to be a donkey while walking around Gene Kelly, and he's like snapping a whip that just makes me say, okay, folks, this is not correct. This is wrong.
To me, that says Netflix. So I will have to see it and give you a full report.
TCM, I think. I don't think it's on Netflix.
Oh, no. Okay.
It's on Turner Classic Movies all the time. Okay, all the time. And it's got great songs like that one in it. But it's got that one scene
that's just so hauntingly bizarre that it can never be unseen.
Basically, that's it. Just burns your eyeballs. Wow, that was good.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was fun to read. So
and I take it was fun to write.
Yeah, I mean, writing is always a bit of a struggle for me, but this book was a pretty joyful experience actually, because I got to spend a lot of time in a world I find really fascinating. So
now this is your debut novel, but you've had a few short stories.
Well, yeah, I've written some stories, and I had one in like a journal when I was in college, but for the most part, like, I'm really a novelist by temperament. You know, I tend to, once I find myself fascinated with a character, like, kind of want to follow them to the ends of the earth. So, I actually wrote a whole collection of linked stories about the protagonist of this novel before I started the actual book that's published. So, and now I'm working on another novel, so I'm kind of a glutton for punishment, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to, and I will ask you about that, but I had to say, by the way, Genevieve Valentine's book is called Mechanique.
Okay.
A novel of the Circus Trisolti.
I have a friend who I think was reading that book, and I looked at it.
Oh,
and
it's a great book. And what was really bizarre is I looked her, I Googled her up and came up not with two photographs of her.
Oh, and there's a picture of you. Yeah.
There's a picture of me with her. I thought that was like...
You're like Zelig. You're everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, God. Yeah.
I mean it as a compliment. Yeah.
Oh, well, I guess. It's. I think there are other people who see it as, well, I hope not creepy, but like fairly constant. But yeah, you've met Genevieve.
Yes.
Yeah, you've met her any number of times because she's been fairly regular on this program.
Terrific, yeah.
And I haven't had her in quite a while, so.
No, she sounds like a really interesting writer, so she's one of them.
And you must have met her because she comes to many of the readings. She's performed at a few.
Yeah, I started going to the New York Review of Science Fiction readings maybe like 3 months ago, 4 months ago.
Ah, then you may not have seen her.
So I might not have met her. Like, Yeah. But I'm planning to be a regular.
She hasn't been there in a little while, but I have every intention of having her back. You know, if I snatch her before Datlow and Kretzel do that, the evil KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series at 85 East 4th Street, the third Wednesday of every month.
I like that you're having a cold war with the KGB.
Well, exactly. I've had real cold wars with them before Matt and Ellen had it. When
was it? Gavin Grant.
It was Gavin and Kelly Link.
Whose work I love so much.
Yeah, she's just a great writer. You know,
she really is a genius.
And Gavin booked Paul Witkover was the curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings.
Yeah,
I was producing it, but he was the curator, and they booked him to read.
Okay.
And it's like, how dare you? How dare you get my curate? So I got Gavin and Kelly to read at my series. So, you know, you take my people, I take you.
Wow.
You know, so we had the curator of one series reading at the other and the curators of the other series reading at mine. And so there. And I've had Matt Kressel read.
Excellent.
Datlow doesn't write, or I would have her read, but I've had her host.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know.
Seems like some nice cross-pollination going on.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and there's also and people should be aware of this also, although not recently, the Kindred reading series.
I'm not familiar with that one. Yeah, where's that?
It is a floating circus, but it's run by Jen Brissett, and it's specifically for writers of color.
Oh, terrific,
you know,
yeah.
And Kindred, of course, is a great story by Octavia Butler. So that's where the name of the reading series comes from.
Yeah.
And she's had nothing but, you know, boring people like N.K. Jemisin and Eliadon Johnson. And
awesome.
I don't want to say Ibiri Salam. Great writers.
Excellent.
There. So every reading series, science fiction reading series in New York, none of them are competition. We are all complementary.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the more that the community can grow, the better it is for everybody. So I mean,
and people go to both.
There's a
slight difference between the audience of one. I consider the KGB series to be more a salon, where people rub elbows and you meet everybody there is a star, you know. And mine is more sort of a little more proscenium, a little more presentation.
Yeah.
And outside of that...
They both seem to really attract lots of interesting writers. So, I plan to keep going to both.
And September 10th.
Uh-huh.
We start up again.
Terrific.
With Richard Bowes, who listeners last week hopefully got a dose of.
Yeah.
And Michael Swanwick.
Cool.
Who's gotten more nominations for Hugos and Nebulas and World Fantasy Awards than anybody else in the world. And last time I had him on, he said, that means I've lost more awards than anybody else in the world. And it's like... He also has won a whole
pack. Yeah.
I've seen people get up at, you know, award ceremonies and say, I'd like to thank Michael Swanwick for not writing this category this year. So.
Yeah. No, I think that, you know, losing because you've been nominated so many times, that's like a good problem to have. So, yeah.
Yeah, and Michael's great.
Terrific. I can't wait to check it out. Like,
well,
that should be a
September
lot of fun.
10th.
I will be there.
And if anybody listening is not on my mailing list, send me an email and I'll put you on my mailing list, which is Jim at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. What's your website?
Oh, it's...
And updated. You should update it more often.
Yes, I need to do that. But it's just www.chandlerclangsmith.com. All run together, no spaces or anything like that. And yeah,
We should spell Clang.
Oh, Clang is with a K. It's K-L-A-N-G.
Yes, so. not like a bell.
Exactly. Not like the sound, but...
Chandler like Raymond.
Yes, Chandler like Raymond, Clang like with a K instead of a C, and Smith the way that you would think it would be spelled.
Yes, as long as you're not British.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, sometimes people spell it with a Y.
Smith, yes.
Yeah, I've seen that before, but yeah. That's the one part of my name that people are unlikely to misspell, so... Yeah. But no, I need to get back to blogging. Also, I used to have a blog that I updated pretty regularly, and then I've been so absorbed in the novel I'm currently writing that I've sort of turned away from criticism and stuff for the time being.
So tell us about the novel you're currently writing.
Well, it is about a parallel universe version of New York City, about 50 years in the future, and it's being attacked by two fire-breathing dragons. So it's about...
Again?
Yeah.
That trope?
Yeah, that old chestnut. So, yeah. Yeah, so it's sort of about the characters and cultures that would develop in, a city that is beset in this way. And I'm really, I have lots of influences. Like, I definitely like the kind of post-apocalyptic writing of someone like George Saunders. I've been a big fan of Gone with Occasional Music by Jonathan Lethem. So
thank you. One of my, when people talk about, the great Jonathan Lethem, they never mention Gone with Occasional Music, which
excellent
I
novel.
Adore. That's his debut novel.
Yeah, it's a delightful novel.
Yeah, and it's like, yes, 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 there's the detective who mm-hmm. is motherless Brooklyn?
Oh yeah, that's the the noir.
He's actually turret syndrome.
Yeah, it's a Lionel Astrog.
That's right. Yes.
And he's kind of
Gun with Occasional Music and his second novel Amnesia Moon.
Yes, I like that one a lot too. That's
one of the best
with the McDonaldonians. Remember
yes,
them? Oh yes. Yeah, that's so good.
One of the best novels that Philip K. Dick never wrote.
Well, I'm sure that Jonathan Lethem would be thrilled to hear you say that, since he's such a big Philip K. Dick fan.
Well, yeah, he's been head of the PKD Society.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a member, so.
Awesome, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know he's been involved with, isn't he involved with the Library of America stuff?
Well, he did the three volumes mm-hmm. of Dick's novels and short stories.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking
for Library of America.
Yeah.
He also did the movie it's just called A Scanner Darkly.
Yes.
Brilliant. Mm-hmm. The only true to Philip K. Dick, one of the only two true to Philip K. Dick movies ever made.
Yeah.
And Lethem does commentary and extras on that.
Oh, man.
And a small piece from Hour of the Wolf is on that.
I have got to get my hands on that. I've seen the film, but I have not gotten the, DVD with all of the commentary and stuff.
It's worth the commentary. And Mike Odell, mm-hmm. of the late Mike Odell of our sister station in L.A., has about 45 minutes with
excellent.
Philip K. Dick on there. That's brilliant. My interview with Philip K. Dick is, wow.
You're
really cool. That's about the insight.
I just started reading Philip K. Dick, actually. I just read Ubik for the first time.
Oh, and you see, that's one of my favorites.
Really right loved there. It. It's really, really excellent. I'd heard that that's one of his best.
I think it is.
Yeah.
He wrote a screenplay for that, and they'll make any movie in the world based on Philip
that
K. Dick.
That is so surprising.
And he wrote a screenplay of Ubik, and nobody will touch it.
That's... Oh, do you have any idea why that is? That's really shocking.
Probably a rights issue. I don't
know.
Yeah,
maybe.
And I had a copy of the screenplay. It was sold in the stores.
Okay.
Legitimate copy.
Nice.
Small press. And I don't know what happened to it. I lost it at PAI years and years and years ago.
Yeah, it would be a very trippy and surreal movie to make, but I would love it.
It would be one, though, with a problem involving... shall we say, a big reveal.
Mm.
And I think that may be a problem of the movie, that it's got the she's a guy problem. That if that's revealed, won't ruin it, but it will take away a major element
mm-hmm.
of surprise.
Yeah, I mean, but it seems like, you know, twists and turns in narrative, it seems like that's one of the things that's attracted people to Philip K. Dick's writing for film. So, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. But
and actually, you know, three movies that are... The one with Matt Damon,
mm-hmm.
which I actually liked, and now I'm blanking.
It's a Philip K. Dick adaptation?
Yeah, yeah. Only about 2 or 3 years old. Recent film. I can look it up and...
I really should know because those tend to be the kinds of movies I seek out, so I should have at least heard of it.
It's a decent one. He plays a politician who keeps meeting up with this lady, only he is not fated to.
Oh, is it the Adjustment Bureau?
That's it.
I have not seen it, but I've heard about it.
I
yeah.
recommend it.
Okay, awesome.
I'm not saying it's a great movie,
I don't think
movie,
I knew that was based on Philip K. Dick.
It a lot,
that's excellent.
And
yeah.
it's truly mm-hmm. decent Philip K. Dick, and a movie that nobody has heard of.
Yeah.
Called Barjo.
Oh, yeah.
B-A-R-J-O. It's a French film based on the novel Confessions of a Crap Artist.
Oh, yeah. You know, I hear that's a really terrific one, too. Yeah,
yeah,
there's
a movie. Nobody knows it was a movie.
That's really funny, yeah. I mean, Philip K. Dick is so prolific that it's kind of hard to know where to start if you haven't already read his work.
Ubik is a good one.
I feel like that was a great introduction to it. Yeah, I mean, I tried reading some of his stories a long time ago and hadn't been as grabbed by those. They almost felt more like sketches or something, you know? Like, I think he just had so many ideas. A lot of it was just getting them down.
Some of them are great. Like, We Can Remember It For You Wholesale.
Yeah, yeah.
Which has been made into a movie poorly twice.
Yeah.
Not once, but twice. Total Recall.
Yeah, yeah. And then there was the remake of Total Recall recently. Yeah. But
that's a 5-page story.
Right, exactly. but Ubik, it was really I was really intrigued by how he melds the technological and the sort of the spiritual. Like it's both mm-hmm. like, you know, there's stuff obviously about death, there's stuff about like dreams, the inside of, you know, human mind, and then that's combined with this this science fiction world building that I really respect. So it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and yeah. I still like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep a whole lot more
than Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blade Runner is a brilliant vision, mm-hmm. but it is Ridley Scott's vision.
Yeah.
Not Philip K. Dick's.
I feel like in a way that's what a good adaptation usually does, right? It adds something to the source material or it makes it necessary, the translation of it into another medium.
That's a good defense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that tends to be true of most of the movies I really like that are based on books vastly change the source. I mean, like, I'm a huge Kubrick fan, for example, and you know, none of his movies are really faithful.
Not at all. That's right.
But it's their faithlessness that makes them so intriguing.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, one of my favorite novels is Shoeless Joe by W.P. Kinsella. And it's a book that you cannot... This guy kidnaps J.D. Salinger.
Okay.
So he can drive cross-country and bring him to his cornfield in Iowa, where he's built an imaginary baseball diamond. This is, of course, made into Field of Dreams.
Oh, wow.
But the novel is unfilmable. If you read the novel, mm-hmm. it is totally a work of the imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet the adaptation of Field of Dreams is so different and so faithful at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, sometimes to be, like, faithful to the spirit of something, it, you know, takes translating it through your own imagination. So, yeah.
You wanna talk to listeners?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, if you would like to call up and speak with Chandler Klang Smith and ask questions about Golden Land, Past Dark, or the new novel.
Yeah.
Then what is the telephone number here? I see the pledge number. 212-650-5782. Again, that's 212-650-5782. And I see calls are already coming in. What a surprise.
Wow.
Good morning. You're on the radio. Oops. No, you're not. You're a dial tone. We only have two working lines here. It's very weird.
Okay.
Hi there. You're on the air.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
I forgot your first name again, darling.
Chandler.
Chandler Klang. I like that. Klang.
Thank you.
Has an emphasis to it. Circuses and clowns. Okay. Let's get to it. In your researches,
mm-hmm.
did you do research on the history, traditions? Because there is a great folklore about circuses and clowns. It goes back thousands of years. And I'm just curious if you did any deep research into that, and I want to share some thoughts with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I necessarily did deep
Should
research.
Should I start
into
the clock on you, Robert?
No. I'll get off in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
No, don't worry.
You get
about
a couple
it.
Of minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think this guy's called before.
Kenny. Anyway, did you come across, speaking of clowns, a very bizarre modern urban legend dealing with abduction of children by phantom clowns out of malls?
No.
1981, a book, a classic volume in the field called The Vanishing Hitchhiker and Other Urban Legends by Jan Harold Brundtland. He's the real maven for American and other urban legends, has a whole section of urban legends dealing with malls and children. And one of them are reports, many of which, you know, never an urban legend is never told in the first person. It's always told third person, of children disappearing from their parents' view and abducted by phantom clowns and sold to illegal sideshows.
Wow, that is really bizarre.
There's dozens of reports. I mean, at least, you know, for an urban legend, it has to have at least 50, you know, variants. One other thing I wanted to ask you, mention to you, I did not know this. Did you ever see the 60 Minutes show or a story done many years ago on what happens to sideshow and circus people who don't travel in the winter? There's a town in Florida, I believe it's called Gibbonton.
Oh, wow.
Where these people reside in the winter. And most of the people who live there, not most, but many of them, are sideshow performers. And they zeroed in on a diner on a Saturday morning.
And everybody was swallowing swords.
Well, they weren't swallowing. Well, some.
Never mind.
Some were.
No, I mean, that sounds incredibly fascinating. Like,
I like the number two, please.
when you said that, I thought of that.
The Toledo over there, that'll do me.
I thought
breakfast.
Of that Hopper painting, only like with, you know, circus freaks instead of instead of the the people picture.
By the way, I like the idea of your New York City alternate. New York City, 50 years. By the way, are the dragons who assailed them Western-type dragons or Eastern dragons?
You know, that's actually something that I've been giving some
it's
thought to.
It's an important question.
It is, because Eastern dragons are so much more sagacious and wise and smart.
Yeah,
I mean, they don't sit on princesses and cords of gold and towers and stuff like that.
They don't sound like Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
I kind of picture there are two dragons in it, and like I kind of picture one of them being more of an Eastern dragon and one of them being more of a Western dragon. But I'm definitely fascinated by the myths and histories of both. So, I mean,
I hope we meet someday, because I'd love to share that with you. By the way, one last quick thing.
Absolutely.
I have a feeling that Chandler's going to, at some point, read at an URSIF, but she hasn't been invited yet.
I've got to stay on your good side.
Don't worry, Chandler. He'll invite you, certainly.
The question is the pairing.
Oh, speaking of dragons.
Maybe another Karen Hewler.
Speaking of dragons, it should be just about now that Naomi Novik's eighth Temeraire novel is coming out. August 12th, I believe somebody told me.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Among other things. So are you going to do more stories in your circus universe, I hope?
I was going to ask that.
Yeah, you know, actually, a few people have been asking me that. And for a long time after I wrote this book, I was, you know, really kind of, I felt like I had kind of exhausted this material and I didn't have anywhere further to go with it. And I still feel like that for, you know, the immediate future. But I've been starting to warm back up to the material, getting to, you know, hear people's reactions to it and talk about it so much lately. So it's definitely not out of the question. Yeah.
I have one thing last thing to say. I'm going to try to have something burned for you. When I say burned, because it's way long out of
You mean
of
a CD.
You mean you're going to take something to a dragon and have them burn it.
No. I'll let Cumberbatch do that, whatever's coming up in December. Looking forward to that, I think. Anyway,
I quit up smogging years ago.
Yes. Well, apparently, James, I'm told he's rather large. At least according to the trailer. He just seems to come around the corner.
Well, actually, he is seen at the end of The Hobbit.
Yeah, very briefly, yeah.
Yes.
Big eye.
Years ago, I attended a music event a weekend, and one of the performers was a man named Marcello Trucci.
Okay.
He was a circus performer and a singer, and he recorded an entire LP, remember LPs, folks, with the holes in the middle that went round and round, of circus songs. So I would love to send you that when I burn it for you. So can we?
Yeah, absolutely. You can get my address from Jim, and I would love to check it out. Or, like, you know, if you come to one of the, you know, New York Review of Science Fiction readings, I go to those every month.
He's usually there.
Yeah.
I hope you'll be there September 10th.
I'm planning on it. So, yeah, I guess I'll see you then.
James will point me out. That's what I'll say.
Absolutely.
Anyway, take care, James. See you on the 10th.
Okay, very good. Have a good morning. And the telephone, we seem to have one working phone line. The telephone number here to talk to Chandler Klang Smith is 212-650-5782. And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica radio, as long as you people sponsor us. Grumble, grumble. The more said about that, the better. You know, we're on the last legs, folks, if we don't do something about it. Good morning, you're on the radio. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm actually a contortionist.
That is so cool.
Who has a lifelong love of science fiction and fantasy.
Oh, my God.
You're like my favorite person. That's amazing. Yeah.
I'm known as Amazing Amy.
That seems apt. Yeah. Where can I see you contort?
Well, right now I'm not performing because I'm 58 years young and I'm having arthritis.
Oh, yeah.
In my hip, so I'm recovering from some treatment, medical treatment. But you can Google Amazing Amy Yoga, and you will see the world's only science fiction and fantasy nerdy and geek-themed contortion act on
far
the planet.
Far effing out.
That sounds really fantastic. I will definitely do that.
And I can't wait to read your book. I've already put it on my Amazon must-read list.
Well, thank you so much. That's so sweet of you.
I've been, you know, also a fan of reading about circuses all my life, so I collect circus literature.
Mm-hmm.
I'm familiar with Genevieve Valentine's book. It's excellent.
Yes, it
is.
And also...
I'm so embarrassed that I forgot the title.
Send people to your website. You have a bunch of great stories.
That's
on
right.
About your characters.
Yeah, I like those are all stories that are sort of backstory to the events that unfold in the novel. So
they're sort of prequels.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like prequels. I actually just started writing about him, several years ago, and he just was one of those characters that wouldn't go away. So. I was just kind of writing him closer and closer to going to the circus. And when I finally got him there, I was like, oh, this is really where the story begins. So, yeah.
I was very impressed with the excerpt that you read. A lot of people try to write about performers who know nothing about performing. And, you know, I usually throw those books down in disgust because they just don't know how much work, time, and effort goes into becoming skillful?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I don't do it myself, but I certainly can see the rigor that's involved. I mean, it's, you know, it is just as difficult and probably more difficult in a lot of ways than what I do. So I have the utmost respect for it.
And I've trained in clowning myself, too.
Oh, that is phenomenal. Wow, yeah.
We have a friend at WBAI who is a... Let's see, I have two clownish friends. Nina mm-hmm. Levine, who is a clown.
Yeah.
And does some fabulous routines. And my friend Amy Sefton, who I haven't seen in years, but I'm in touch with on Facebook and stuff, who has been around the country as a clown.
Wow, yeah. No, that's just really, really interesting. So it's Amazing Amy that I should have...
Amazing Amy Yoga. Everybody out there, if you feel like it, Google that. You'll see...
I'm going to have to.
Jedi Yoga and Yoga Trek.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Are you teaching...
Years of stretch before the only...
Are you teaching in New York?
I'm strictly an entertainer. I don't teach.
Oh, you're not teaching yoga. You just do it. Okay.
Cool.
But right now I'm on a hiatus until my hip gets better.
I really wish you luck with that. That's really tough.
Yeah, well, I mean, the good news is they're doing such amazing things. We have a mutual friend who mm-hmm. has had, Karen Hewler, who has been dealing with hip issues. And it's just amazing what they do.
Yeah. No, I mean, it seems like there are definitely a lot of good medical technologies out there and stuff. But it's never fun to be, you know. dealing with something.
Especially for a contortionist.
Yeah.
Older is absolutely horrible. But as far as I know, there's no one else at my age doing what I do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, like, you know, I definitely hope that you recover so you can keep at it, because it sounds like a really wonderful, you know, wonderful ability and skill that you've worked hard to
acquire. And amazing.
There is nothing I've ever done in my life that I have loved as much as performing.
Yeah.
And although I have never earned a living from it, and I've never achieved media recognition or fame, or certainly never fortune.
Hey, we're giving you media recognition this second.
And I've been actually rejected by all the major show places and circuses for reasons probably having to do with my age.
Yeah.
And even Coney Island would not hire me to perform in their sideshow.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Because of my age.
That's really, like... That's really disappointing, because I love the Coney Island sideshow.
I mean,
they
all know me over there.
Yeah.
Keegan knows me, and they will not hire me.
Wow,
well,
that sucks.
Well, you know, those people also change there, so you'll have to just keep...
Yeah.
Keep at it.
Yeah, keep persevering with it, but, yeah. No, I mean, you
and
know...
in the meantime, we can all see you on YouTube.
Yes, you can.
Doing the tango? The
yoga tango?
It's funny because I'm so the opposite of a natural performer. I'm, you know, even something like this makes me, you know, public speaking always makes me very nervous. And when people are able to tell a story through, you know, like through clowning, through, you know, being a contortionist, through, you know, acrobatics, all kinds of things like that, it's really foreign to me. But I think that's part of why I'm so fascinated by it, because it's sort of like, what would it be like to see the world through, you know, through this completely different set of eyes. So, yeah.
Well, I think you'd be really interested in a project that I'm going to be involved with later this fall, involving future clowns.
Oh, okay.
Ooh.
Excellent. Yeah, I would
and
be.
I would love to keep in touch with you off the air. Are you New York based?
Yeah, I live here in the city, and you can find... Yeah, you can find my email address on my website, so, yeah.
Or Facebook.
Or Facebook. I'm on Facebook, too, so,
yeah, me too. So I will email you what I call my e-resume.
Okay.
And I would love to meet with you and get in touch with you. I mean, my...
And clown around, right?
And literally, yeah, well, you know.
No, absolutely. Like, yeah, definitely get in touch with me. That would be fantastic.
And Jim, I love your show. I've been listening to you for, well, decades. I mean, since Margot Adler has been around, that's how many years.
Yeah, well, she's the best.
Yep. Yeah, so, you know, I the world's only geek and nerdy science fictiony contortionist. I'd love to keep in touch with you more also.
Okay, well, I'm jim@ourwolf.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, it's been wonderful.
And we hear the audio of you in the background.
Yeah.
So.
Okay,
well, I'll connect with you off the radio sometime soon, I'm sure.
That's wonderful. I mean, I really think I would love to get you involved with this future clown project.
Okay, I'm really intrigued. So, yeah, I will check it out.
All right. Thank
awesome.
You so okay. much.
Thank you, Amy.
Okay.
Take care. Have a great
Good
morning. Good night.
Bye.
Morning, night, whatever it may be.
We have
just a 3 minutes left. Can you believe? Before
wow.
we have to play outro. Yeah,
it just flew by.
It does do that. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at Amy on YouTube over here.
Terrific. Yeah.
Neat. Yeah. So we can try to sneak in one more call at 212-650-5782, but we also have to remind people that to go to, let's spell the whole thing out, chandlerklangsmith.com.
Yes, that is exactly right. So, yeah, please check out my website, and there are, you know, some short stories on there, you know, information about me, about the book, reviews the book's gotten, things like that. So it would be, it would be great if some of the listeners want to check it out.
Yeah, and let's try one more. Good morning, you're on the air.
Yes, I was wondering if anyone has ever heard of a theosophist book by Madame H.P. Blavatsky.
Oh, yes.
Called The Secret Doctrine.
As a matter of fact, in the very, very, very early days of Hour of the Wolf, Margot Adler, who created this show, did a lot about her and specifically spoke about that book. And I read it, but I mean, we're talking 40 years ago.
Okay.
Madame Blavatsky.
You know, it's kind of like you're trying to read Aldous Huxley in a way, because you have to reread each paragraph, like, you know, four times at least.
Right? Yeah, it's true.
It's really fascinating. Because I'm a conservative politically, but I'm an artist, and I've always, you know, worked my whole life in performing arts and in acting and in painting and in all of those things, and so I think that brings me into another sphere, and things started happening several years ago, I think, to everyone around after the 9/11 period. And I think that by discovering this book, there are so many answers to so much of what's going on currently. It's a tough read.
It is a tough read, yeah.
Yeah, if you're not used to reading, they have pamphlets. But they talk about, they even address the Big Bang Theory.
She does, which I contest. I'm with Fred Hoyle on the solid state theory. Just to be weird.
I mean, I contest it also, because I feel that, I mean,
and so did, I believe so did Velikovsky, unless I'm mistaken.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, by the way.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to know, I'll call your program. Again, my name's Valentina, and it's the first time I've ever heard of you.
Well, so, I've been here for over 40 years. What can I say?
Amazing. I love you both.
Well,
we're both so
And Chandler,
I've been here for one night.
She's been here for one night, and when I started this show, she wasn't a gleam in anybody's eye.
Nope. Yeah. Oh.
Well, I'm sure she is now.
I hope. Oh, yes. Okay, thank you so much. Have
a
good morning.
My pleasure.
Okay.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, let's see. Oh, yeah. Ooh, 30 seconds over already, if you can believe
Yikes.
That. Yeah, the time she flies along like an aerialist.
Thanks for having me on the show, Jim.
Well, thanks so much, and this won't be the last time.
Okay.
Assuming the station survives anyway. And, again, everybody, the name of the book is Goldenland, one word, Past Dark. Ignore every time I say After Dark. It's not that. That's some old software. It's Golden Land Past Dark by Chandler Klang Smith. And she'll be around with
Terrific.
New stories and books.
Yeah, I hope so.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. You can find the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, and you can visit ourwolf.com if you want to see what a website looked like 40 years ago. And, well, it's old, but it's semi-up-to-date. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way over these same airwaves in, well, just moments. Good morning. Thank you for listening. See you next week.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on.
palace to light up your fire. When I and I catch them vampires, I and I go set them on fire. I'm and trot up down a unity lane, see a dreadlocks running down a rasta man. Swear that if he catches me, we'll kill him dead. The dreadlocks couldn't catch the rasta man. Obadiah, Obadiah, Jah Jah sent us here to catch vampire. Obadiah, Obadiah, Jah Jah sent us here to catch vampire. We have the chalice to light up your fire. When I and I catch them vampire, I and I go set them on fire. A true Rasta man does not gamble. A true Rasta man does not play card pack. A true Rasta man always humble. Obadiah, Obadiah, Jah Jah sent us here to catch vampire. Obadiah, Obadiah, Jah Jah sent us here to catch vampire. We have the chalice to light up Jah fire. Set them on fire. To catch vampire. Obadiah, Obadiah, Jah Jah sent us here to catch vampire. We have the chalice to light up Jah fire. When I and I catch them vampire, I and I go set them on fire.
Sinker list alive right here at exactly 8 minutes after 3 o'clock. The new rebooted WBAI 99 Sinker right here in New York City, y'all. Yeah. At exactly 8 minutes after the hour, you know, John Lou got the right idea. You know, legalize it, decriminalize it. You ain't got no choice, y'all.
The brain's food.
8 minutes after 3 o'clock, y'all.
Whoa, oh, 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 oh. The lamb's bread.
My Jamaican breakfast.
It's been a long, long time. It's been a long, long time.
But watch your man.
Since I wanna burn up my lamb's bread.
Not to be confused with my Manhattan.
And so I wanna burn up my lamb's bread.
Manhattan
I
breakfast.
I never take to do no one around.
Yo, this is Burn Baby Burn. Now you know why we had to call the show Burn Baby Burn, y'all. Because the true test of a democratic society is how they treat democracy, or how they treat weed. In imperialist America, they treat democracy like weed. It's not legal.
Oh yeah, the brain's food. The lamb's bread. It's been a long, long time since I wanna burn up my lamb's bread.
And from I man a burn up a lamb spread. I never check to do no one around. But everywhere I go, I'm an hear them say, it make you do this, and it make you do that. But I wanna tell them, I this I want ya, I make you do no one no wrong. No, this I want ya, make you do no one no wrong. Tell you, oh no, I am telling you, each and everyone, this I want ya. When I'm on burn up, I lamb spread. I'm on feeling irate. I'm on feeling nice. I'm on feel alright. And I not do no one no wrong. No. And I not do no one no wrong. Tell you, oh no. Brothers and sisters, listen to me. I will never stop from burning up my lamb's bread. Oh no. I love up my lamb's bread. I burn up my lamb's bread. I man meditate day and night. So strong. Open Jaja. Open and pray. He will help I one day. I want lamb with me, I do no one wrong. I want lamb with me, I do no one wrong. Can you, oh no. It's been a long, long time. It's been a long, long time. I man a burn up my lamb spread. And from I man a burn up my lamb spread. I never take to do no one around.
Children, watch this.